NBC News reported that extremists are using Telegram, an encrypted communication app, to urge violence and even share knowledge of how to make guns and bombs. Multiple media outlets also confirmed an ABC News report that the FBI expect armed pro-Trump protesters in all 50 state capitals and Washington before Inauguration Day. Trump's potential to fuel further unrest is a source of anxiety. Behind the scenes, Donald Trump has reportedly continued his retreat into paranoia and unreality, repeating in a conversation with the House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy the lie that so-called Antifa left-wing activists, not his supporters, were responsible for death and destruction inside the Capitol building. "It's not Antifa," Kevin McCarthy reportedly replied. "It's MAGA. I know, I was there." MAGA refers to the Trump slogan, "Make America Great Again." The House voted on Tuesday night, 12th of January, on a resolution seeking the use of the 25th Amendment, which provides for the removal of a president deemed unfit for office, although it has never been used. Dependent on the Vice President Mike Pence, the gambit failed because of Pence's refusal to cooperate. After days of silence between the pair, Donald Trump and Mike Pence held a good conversation at the White House on Monday, 11th of January. The conversation on Monday evening was, according to an unnamed official telling the Reuters news agency. Some who responded to Donald Trump's call to storm the Capitol building, prompting clashes in which a police officer was killed, a rioter was shot dead, and three others died, were caught on video chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," after he withstood demands for the president that he engineer overturning the election result, which is not in his power. House of Representatives vote to impeach Donald Trump on one article for incitement of insurrection occurred on Wednesday. The timetable for an ensuing Senate trial is uncertain. Unlike Trump's first impeachment in December of 2019, a sizable number of Republicans in the House and a handful of Senate Republicans have signaled support for impeachment. Those lawmakers included Liz Cheney, the third-ranking House Republican. Republicans expect up to 20 GOP lawmakers to vote for impeachment, according to a report by Punchbowl. Meanwhile, Ted Lieu, a Democratic congressman, told MSNBC Network, "We don't actually need a lot of evidence here because it's all out in the open. There is no dispute that Donald Trump gave a speech. There is no dispute there was an attack on the Capitol building, and there is no dispute that multiple people died." Last week's huge security failure is under growing scrutiny. The Washington Post said it had obtained an internal FBI document from the day before the attack warning extremists were preparing to commit violence and war. The report undermined previous claims that the FBI had no intelligence about an imminent attack. The FBI and the Department of Justice on Tuesday held the first press conference by any part of the U.S. federal government since the Capitol attack. Michael Shervin, federal prosecutor for the District of Columbia, indicated that many amid the hundreds of pro-Trump rioters who violently invaded the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday, 6th of January, are suspected in a mind-blowing range of crimes, including felony, murder and sedition, and conspiracy. Neither the Department of Justice nor the FBI has explained how the security failures came about at the Capitol building, but Michael Shervin said rioters were being pursued across the country. "The range of criminal conduct was unmatched," Shervin said, and warned lawbreakers, "You will be charged and you will be found." The former federal cybersecurity chief Chris Krebs, who Donald Trump fired for saying the election was secure, told CNN, "This is the equivalent of ignoring the pain in your chest for a couple of weeks, and then all of a sudden you have a catastrophic heart attack. We are on the verge of what I fear to be a pretty significant breakdown in democracy and civil society in the United States." We'll be right back.
Trump government enters its last day in office, every effort is being taken by the White House and the State Department to divert attention away from its woeful behaviour at home and making sure that the international arena gets one last taste of Trumpism. The United States has introduced a fresh round of sanctions against the Yemeni Ansar Allah resistance movement, going as far as labelling the group as a designated terrorist organisation. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stated that he had declared three senior leaders of the movement as global terrorists, including Abdul Malik al-Houthi. However, it seems that by acting in this way, the US has done nothing to alleviate the ongoing war in the region, in particular when it comes to the terrible humanitarian disaster taking place in Yemen, which for the whole part sees the US and its regional allies wholly responsible for. With war raging on in the country, it seems that many people have forgotten about the disastrous impact on human life, with over 233,000 Yemenis dying from the impact of the conflict. It's hence why the Ansar Allah movement has highly condemned the actions of Mike Pompeo, as well as the lack of actions by the UN humanitarian team, who has failed to act, in essence, making them equally as guilty as the Americans for their lack of positive action. With very little to no humanitarian aid being able to enter the country, has the actions by Trump and Pompeo made things harder for life-saving drugs, equipment and medicine to reach the country. Although not all lives have been taken from the impact of the war, it's the connected impact that has hit Yemen the hardest, with many people, especially children, who are suffering the most, either through the lack of clean, potable drinking water, lack of fresh and healthy, nutritious food, and of course through lack of much-needed medical supplies, in particular as Yemen, like all other global nations, is facing a pandemic that knows no borders. When it comes to Yemen, the relentless campaign by the Saudi regime has caused a terrible loss of life and economic infrastructure to the country. Yet, every fire is being fueled from somewhere, and it's the United States that are fanning the flames in this case. In fact, in a similar last-minute action by the US on designating the Ansar Allah movement a terrorist group, the US has also struck a last-second deal to supply the Saudi regime with $290 million worth of arms, most of which, again, will be used in the war against Yemen, whilst at the same time funding the US military complex with the same brushstroke. But it's not just the Saudi regime that's guilty of crimes against Yemen. Its regional partner, the United Arab Emirates, is also embroiled in the war, and much like its neighbour in Riyadh, Abu Dhabi has also enjoyed the support of the US arms industry, securing a $23 billion arms deal with Washington, signed and sealed by none other than Donald J. Trump. With over 3,000 children killed since 2015 in Yemen, over 5,600 injured, and many more being added to the list on a monthly basis, why then are the people of Yemen being sanctioned and punished, yet those responsible for the atrocities are being rewarded by the US? With Trump having promised to end endless wars, why then does he continue to fund his regional allies, allowing the US to continue its global conflicts via its proxies? And will the arrival of a new US president spell any notion of change in US foreign policy, allowing the likes of Yemen to rise from the ashes and fight the humanitarian disaster that struck this ancient land?
On Friday, the United States imposed sanctions on chairman of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, Faleh al-Fayyad, accusing him of human rights abuses during anti-government demonstrations in the Arab country in late 2019. Iraq's foreign ministry slammed as unacceptable the U.S. Treasury Department's blacklisting of the 64-year-old. The ministry said it will carefully pursue all decisions made by the Treasury against Iraqi figures during both the current and the incoming U.S. administrations and will attempt to address the ramifications. Meanwhile, the leader of the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq also issued a statement strongly denouncing the new U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of his country's sovereignty. The move also drew condemnations from Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movements. In a statement, Hezbollah said the new sanctions are the latest entry in the list of U.S. crimes against the Iraqi government and people, while Ansarullah deemed the sanctions as another sign of Washington's animosity toward the Arab nation.
So when the United States now sees that the Ashqal Sha'abi, the popular mobilization forces in in Iraq are, even though they are led by an established politician, a well-respected political leader with a long state of service that is now the chairman of the Hashd al-Sha'abi, despite all of this, the United States will still consider this person to be a potential threat. However, from the perspective of the United States, the U.S. imperialist perspective, the Hashd al-Sha'abi presents a domestic and a homegrown, purely Iraqi domestic resistance against terrorism, but also against imperialism, against foreign hegemony, and against, you know, attempts to overtake the country and to make Iraq into a puppet state, as it sort of was in the first few years after the 2003 invasion.
The Ansarullah movement voiced confidence that the sanctions would not affect the Iraqi people's will to free their homeland and drive the occupying forces out of their country. The PMU celebrated its leader being hit by U.S. sanctions, saying it's an honor for the Iraqi official to be viewed as one of Washington's enemies, alongside Iran and Iraq's top commanders who were assassinated in a drone strike ordered by President Donald Trump. The PMU was formed by popular volunteer forces in 2014 after the Daesh terror group launched a campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Iraq. The group played a major role in pushing back and ultimately defeating the terrorist forces, which had taken control of large swathes of the Arab country. The Iraqi parliament voted to integrate the PMU into the Iraqi military in 2016, effectively placing the force under the command of Prime Minister and granting the group a standing similar to that of other branches of Iraqi security forces. But even that hasn't kept the U.S. from putting extra pressure on the group, similar to any other forces that stand against Washington's hegemony in the region.
Indeed, despite the fact that the United States, they talk a lot about the war on terror ever since the Bush era, but in reality we have seen that the United States arms and supports terrorist organizations all over the globe. This goes from Colombian drug lords to Salafi Wahhabi Takfiri gangs in Iraq, to ethnic supremacists trying to break apart the nations of Iran and Pakistan, for example. This is a global campaign of support to real terrorists, and at the same time, a campaign of targeting, assassinating, and attacking, slandering, and trying to imprison people who actually fight against these terrorists.
But the U.S. actions against the resistance in the region are provoking their correspondent reactions. Anti-U.S. sentiment in West Asia is on the rise, with more people calling for the ouster of U.S. from West Asia by the day.
What the world saw on Wednesday with pro-Trump mobs storming the U.S. Capitol was the peak of a year of white nationalist and anti-democratic violence across the U.S., violence that steadily intensified and feature the direct incitements of the U.S. president. Last February, the FBI issued a report to Congress warning that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists had become the primary source of domestic terrorist threats and killings. In the past couple of years, white supremacist groups have been causing violence and disruption in the U.S. They're often blamed for growing instances of hate crime and aggravated harassment in the country. Many people have linked this type of violence to the inflammatory rhetoric that the U.S. president used in his speeches. In fact, Trump's constant siding with white supremacist groups, who often disrupt protests and rallies carrying semi-automatic rifles, alarmed many of an eruption of a possible conflict in the country. And on January 6th, that conflict happened. Trump has been accused of inciting a mob of supporters to stage an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. 5 people have died, dozens have gotten arrested, and Bipartisan is outraged.
It's an extraordinary situation that we've seen in Washington. When you look at the numbers of people who were rioters who worked their way into the Capitol, this is incredibly dangerous. In fact, we've never really seen anything like this, certainly not in my lifetime. And this isn't just Donald Trump. There were those who supported him, but clearly by the thousands, what we saw were right-wing extremists, we saw racist groups, we saw others who are all part of this rioting process. And when you look at the buildup over the last 4 years, this isn't particularly shocking.
People now believe that Donald Trump and every politician who promoted the falsehood that the November election was stolen bear tremendous responsibility for riling the supporters who disrupted the counting of the Electoral College vote confirmation. After what happened in the U.S. Capitol, many politicians called for Trump's removal from office before Biden's inauguration. They said that Trump's final days as U.S. president pose a grave national security threat and warrant his immediate removal from office. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the U.S.
He's not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying that his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said that she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave the Oval Office voluntarily.
It's difficult to remove a sitting president. You have the possibility of the 25th Amendment. But the 25th Amendment requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. And even then, if the president refuses, you then have to take it to Congress. That's hard. There's only a few days left in Trump's presidency. The other option is impeachment. That, too, is politically complicated, and it takes time. And so it's difficult to do it very, very quickly. But I think it highlights something bigger, something more broad. And that's that the fact that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it was the vice president who was working his way around the president, actually excluding the president from the chain of command, is something simply unprecedented. So it really highlights just how dangerous this actually is, and I think the realities of the difficulty of removing a sitting president.
It's not just the Democrats who seek to remove Trump. Republicans are also calling for his impeachment. They say what Trump did on Wednesday can happen any other time. He has already said that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. But there's still a possibility that he can call another 50,000 people to Washington and create another deadly chaos. Many believe that the U.S. president can even do worse and launch nuclear war on his way out of the White House. That is why officials are trying to close every possible door to chaos. The U.S. President's prized Twitter account has been permanently suspended, and Facebook and Instagram have banned him indefinitely. In the meantime, Pelosi talked to the head of the U.S. military, seeking available precautions for preventing Trump from initiating military hostilities or accessing the launch codes. But although Trump's political power is draining away, his cult of personality still commands tremendous loyalty among his Make America Great Again fan base. That's the reason behind a recent joint statement from all 10 living former U.S. defense secretaries, in which they warned against the military interfering in a peaceful transfer of power.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the US. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major U.S. towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting a huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the U.S. government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the U.S., not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump, for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the US economy, and of course the disgusting behavior demonstrated by Trump and his droogs. So did the leader have a point when he delivered his observations this time round?
He does have a point, because I think what people aren't recognizing when they see the US from the outside is that it's going through a fundamental decline. That's hard to believe, and the decline is often not easily, if you like, recognizable. But let me just give you a few indicators. Since 2008, the United States has gone into a 200% increase, a surge in its national debt. $27 trillion is the current United States debt. That's, you know, 200% increase, as I say, over the last 10 or so years.
With the imminent departure of Donald Trump, the arrival of a US president has left some people feeling optimistic of change, both in America and around the world. Many have questioned the notion of the US and Iran reconciling sometime in the near future under the presidency of Joe Biden. However, with the leader stating that some feel if this happens, Iran will become a paradise, will a relationship with the Americans genuinely benefit Iran?
Well, I think that, again, Ayatollah Khamenei points to this idea of people who may think that a deal with America will in some way give economic benefits to Iran overnight. This is not going to be the case. You know, the deals that the Iranians will have to do in order to really stand any chance of any kind of collaboration from America are, I think, are going to be morally impossible for Iran to go ahead with.
But the truth of the matter is, Iran's in no rush to reach out the hand of friendship to the US, with the Americans imposing sanctions on Iran, as well as assassinating Iran's chief counterterrorism commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. It's also why Iran are not waiting for a knock on the door from America to rejoin the JCPOA. With Iran proving itself to be a successfully self-sufficient nation, as well as showing the world that it was and still is more than able to stand up and defeat the American maximum pressure policy, it's no wonder that Iran can stand tall, proud, and confident in its rhetoric. With an abundance of natural resources, four seasons that gift Iran with a fertile and beautiful land, and of course a culture spanning back 5,000 years, it seems that Iran has a lot to be proud of and is already a slice of paradise.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The article you're about to hear under the heading Graphs Show That Black Scientists in the United States Are Underrepresented at Every Level has been authored by Betsy Ladizetz, who is a freelance science writer based in Brooklyn, New York, United States. Stay with us for more of Betsy Ladizetz's article. nationwide protests in the United States in response to the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other unarmed black men and women in the first part of 2020 inspired calls to action within academia's ivory tower. Social media movements brought attention to discrimination faced by black students and professionals throughout the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics pipelines. U.S. black residents studying and working in STEM fields are underrepresented at every level, from undergraduate degree programs to the workforce. The academic environment fails to support black students, says economist Gary Hoover at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Black students in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics are some of the most talented people around, and if the environment isn't going to be welcoming, these folks just take their talents elsewhere. More U.S. students are getting science and engineering degrees than ever before, but the gap for black and African-American students in these fields has been stubbornly wide, as population-adjusted figures show. In 2018, the most recent year for which data is available, about 238 of every 100,000 U.S. residents earned a science, technology, engineering and mathematics bachelor's degree. If the black community was adequately represented in science, technology, education and mathematics higher education, its rate would be similar. 238 of every 100,000 black residents would have earned these degrees. Yet only 161 of every 100,000 black residents had done so. The gap continues into graduate school. In 2018, African-American residents were 12.3% of the U.S. population, but only 8.4% of bachelor's graduates, 8.3% of master's graduates, and just 5.5% of doctoral graduates. From 2000 to 2018, the rising number of African-American students in U.S. science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degree programs mirrored the upward trend of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics students overall, but the representation gap held firm. Displaying the graduation figures by population makes clear that black students are earning science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degrees at lower levels than black people are represented in the overall U.S. population. African-American science, technology, engineering, and mathematics students make their way up the academic ladder, they may face learning and research environments that are unsupportive or actively hostile. In a 2018-2019 study by the American Institute of Physics, black students in physics reported that they commonly experience a lack of financial support, as well as microaggressions, small interactions in which peers or superiors question a person's presence or performance due to racially charged bias. These experiences negatively affected the person's sense of belonging in the field. The study results were based on a survey of 232 students, 53 of whom identified as black or black biracial. In the survey, 42% of black physics students reported that their department creates a supportive environment most times, compared with 53% of their white colleagues. 4% of the African-American students reported that their department never creates a supportive environment. None of the white students selected this response in the survey. As I reflect on my own academic journey, there were fewer and fewer black students in my program, says anthropologist Stephanie Poindexter of the University of Buffalo in New York. Stephanie Poindexter was one of the very few black students studying primates in her undergraduate program, and representation narrowed further as she progressed towards her PhD. What I see is a lot of untapped potential, Poindexter says. Interested students of color who are not fostered into higher degrees in the same way that other students are fostered. Within the United States, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics workforce, black scientists are also underrepresented, as are Hispanics and Latino and Native American scientists, according to a 2017 official government data. In 2017, black residents, Hispanics or Latino residents, and Native Americans and Alaskan Natives were severely underrepresented among U.S. scientists, engineers, and healthcare professionals when compared with the overall populations for these identities. Among 11 science, technology, engineering, and mathematics professionals reviewed by the National Center for Science and Engineering Statistics, or NCSES, only one field demonstrates a rate of black representation that is close to the overall population. 92 of every 100,000 black residents are social scientists, compared with 122 of every 100,000 U.S. residents overall. The disparity is especially severe in engineering. For example, 29 out of every 100,000 U.S. residents are chemical engineers, compared with 2 of every 100,000 black residents. Young black potential engineers have few role models that look like them and or come from similar backgrounds that they can emulate, manifesting in a deficit in the younger students cultivating these skills, says Aaron Kyle, a senior lecturer in biomedical engineering design at Columbia University's School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Aaron Kyle also notes that minority scientists may be cited less than their peers, leading to challenges in career advancement. Among U.S. engineers, black representation is lowest in chemical engineering. Disparities in salary are found in most, but not all, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields. Computer science has the largest disparity, with a median annual salary in 2017 of $97,000 for white professionals, compared to just $72,000 for black professionals in computer science. There are so few working black mathematicians that the NCSES couldn't even make a comparison. Once employed, U.S. black science, technology, engineering, and mathematics graduates tend to be paid less than their colleagues from other racial backgrounds, according to 2017 data. When black students shift to other tracks, black communities suffer from a lack of doctors, lack of researchers and engineers who directly understand their experiences and needs. To improve black representation in science, Poindexter, Hoover and Kyle all say that solutions must include new offerings of grants, promotions and other research programs dedicated to supporting black science, technology, engineering and mathematics students from elementary school into the workforce. According to Poindexter, there needs to be a concentrated effort and financial commitment to balance the scales in the next 1 to 5 years.
Around the World with Reporters.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we lack some information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil ministry has signed major investment agreements with domestic contractors in a bid to boost crude oil production. As part of the deals, the National Iranian South Oil Company and the Iranian Offshore Oil Company agreed to contract out major onshore projects in four oil-rich provinces, as well as offshore projects in the Persian Gulf, to domestic companies. The projects are worth $1.2 billion. Oil Minister Bijan Namdar Zanganeh says this is the last stage of a plan that aims to boost Iran's crude output by some 300,000 barrels a day.
We have pursued this plan since a few years ago, and today the 31st contract was signed. The agreements will ramp up the output by increasing the recovery factor of our oil fields. This is estimated to add about $1.5 billion annually to our total oil income.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The country's oil production has almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day since U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed unilateral oil embargoes on Iran 3 years ago. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels a day, down from 2.5 million. Zanganeh says Iran plans to increase its oil production by more than twofold next year, to 4.5 million barrels per day.
Due to the sanctions, the share of oil exports in our annual budget has slashed by 14%, but the restrictions have pushed us to discover new domestic capacities to keep the oil industry afloat. All of these contracts have been signed with Iranian contractors. Furthermore, over 70% of the needed equipment are manufactured indigenously. We are not going to relinquish our domestic capacities in the oil industry, even if the sanctions are lifted.
Last year, oil exports accounted for 35% of Iran's budget. Along with the U.S. sanctions, the coronavirus pandemic has also squeezed Iran's oil revenues by cutting global demand.
While Iran is poised to make a strong comeback to the oil market, officials say crude revenues will cover only 25% of the country's next year budget, despite a projected rise in exports. This is Tehran is making a strategic shift to non-oil revenues to shield the economy from the ups and downs of its petroleum sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
...2021 will not be any better than the previous years for the health sector in Yemen. This was confirmed by Health Minister Taha al-Mutawakkil in a press conference in the capital Sana'a in response to questions regarding the future of the health situation in Yemen amid the war.
The suffering we are facing today is immense. The needs of the Yemeni people are huge and the infrastructure is poor. Then comes the aggression and the unjust blockade on Yemen, which contributed to the partial or total destruction of medical facilities. more than 315 medical facilities were destroyed by the aggression, including medical centers where international organizations were working. Medicines and medical equipment were also banned from entering the country.
The health minister expects 90% of medical equipment to be out of service in the upcoming weeks due to the end of their lifespan, the continuation of the blockade, and the oil derivatives crisis that has affected the power generation.
The international support provided to the Yemeni's health sector can only account for a maximum of 20% of the shortages in light of the spreading disease and the growing number of malnourished patients. All these are the result of the war and the siege imposed on Yemenis.
The health sector in Yemen has faced a tragic situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, during which tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, were killed and millions of families were displaced. Continued silence is still the position of the United Nations and international community towards the suffering of the people of Yemen, while the Saudi-led blockade has deprived them of most of their basic needs in life. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation, as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems, and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today, we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interests of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow broker deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and seven surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the U.S. Experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agree to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Khankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, deepening work continues. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
What President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed the lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
Yesterday, we presented the case to Iran's Shahid Beheshti Court for International Affairs. Of course, the case will demand that those culpable in the killing of the nuclear scientists face justice. Such a case is not unprecedented, since the U.S. has for several times taken a similar path against our government and froze our government's foreign assets.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but it is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's criminal agenda. If finalized, the case will lead to the seizure of $100 million of U.S. assets in foreign banks.
The legal action comes over a month after the assassination of top Iranian nuclear figure Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which, as in the previous incidents, Iran blames on Israel. Israel has a history of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth victim. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the killings, its footsteps can be tracked. In video recorded in 2018, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Coupled with the EU's lack of commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, the assassination of Fakhrizadeh made Iran change its policy with regards to its nuclear program. In response, the Islamic Republic officially announced that it resumed enriching uranium at 20% purity, markedly distancing from the 3.67% cap set by the nuclear deal. The legal team here says the lawsuit against the U.S. pursues a single goal: to break the chain of its unlawful targeting of its key scientists. However, while the five slain scientists are viewed as the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry, officials say the sector is up and running. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives is expected to consider launching an impeachment process against the U.S. president on Wednesday. The Democratic lawmakers say they will move ahead with the measure if Vice President Mike Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment, an article that would immediately unseat the president if he is deemed unfit for office.
That's going to be very difficult to achieve, one, because I don't think Vice President Pence is inclined to do so, probably viewing it as political suicide for his future in case he wants to run for president in the future. So I don't think that one's likely. In the context of impeachment, it is a political process, and right now, I think the will is there by the Democratic Party, and it seems like even some Republicans may be interested.
So far, we've seen an unwillingness of Pence, in particular, to move forward with the 25th Amendment, and Trump, of course, is not taking responsibility or taking it upon himself to resign, as he has been called upon to do. So I'm not surprised that impeachment is likely to be the result.
Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers are calling for Trump's removal from office, citing his conduct and rhetoric. Experts say the lack of bipartisan balance in the calls, however, can put U.S. national security at risk.
I think there's certainly a risk of something atrocious happening. I hope, hearing that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, has been in contact with Pentagon officials, there may be some checks, but it does reveal somewhat of a danger in our process in terms of how powerful the executive is, and maybe we should think about that in the future.
The longer he remains in office, he still has access to all kinds of classified information and security codes. He has been isolating himself, which elevates the level of uncertainty about his actions in the coming days and weeks. So yeah, I think there's definitely reason to be concerned about our overall security.
Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi underlined the urgency to remove Trump by speaking with Pentagon officials about safeguards of the president's access to the nuclear codes in the last days of his presidency. To make matters worse for Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice hasn't ruled out filing charges of insurrection, sedition, and attempted coup against him. Reporting from Miami, Rodney Carvello.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are still rising in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The number of infections has risen to over 45,000, mostly since August of last year. Hospitals in Gaza continue to run low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector.
The international community must exert real pressure on Israel to end its illegal blockade of Gaza and allow local authorities to combat the coronavirus pandemic. The international community must also provide badly needed medical aid to the overwhelmed health sector in Gaza, which is already in a bad shape and struggling to fight the coronavirus.
The pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip, threatening the socio-economic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are terrified by the rapid spread of coronavirus infections. Our hospital lack of vital equipment and medicines, and our health system has been battered by the Israel blockade.
The economy has been hit hard by the pandemic, and people are afraid and hardly have any income. Nowadays, it is very hard to maintain a business because of the tight restrictions.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19. They currently impose lockdowns from 8 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
The emergency measures, including lockdowns, will continue in order to fight the spread of the virus. We call on everyone to stay at home during the lockdowns and abide by safety measures.
Human rights groups have repeatedly warned of the catastrophic implications of coronavirus spread in the Gaza Strip.
Experts say Israel's inhumane practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to fight the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The
Iranian experts and ophthalmologists have gathered in Tehran to unveil a new method in eye surgery which enables the doctors to cure problems in their offices without anesthesia and bleeding. Panisplexer offers an alternative to invasive surgical procedures, reducing recovery time and any complications that can arise before and after surgery. It is an innovative development in eye treatments by utilizing the fourth state of matter, or plasma.
This new technique that uses plasma is being practiced for the first time. Within the past 20 years, plasma has been used in dentistry, treatment of cancer, and scar healing. Since some years ago, we decided to use it in ophthalmology to make sure it is safe. Almost 15 eye diseases can be cured at the doctor's office without going to the surgery room.
This is an international event to unveil a low-cost method for eye disorder treatments. It is a pain-free Iranian method called PANIS, or plasma-assisted non-invasive surgery. This is a result of 5 years of collaboration between two Iranian companies and an Italian counterpart.
This method has been practiced in many countries, but Iranian scientists have now turned it to a method to decrease treatment costs, as it does not need surgery rooms and hospital beds.
Such outstanding achievements show that the sanctions by the West have not been able to slow down Iran's advancement, proving that the Islamic Republic is moving forward on the right track. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has canceled a trip to Europe at the last minute after European officials were publicly critical of President Donald Trump's role in last week's storming of the Capitol building in Washington. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Julian Borgia. The piece is titled, Pompeo Scraps Europe Trip After EU Leader Calls Trump Political Pyromaniac. Stay with us for more of Julian Borgia's article. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has canceled a trip to Europe at the last minute after European officials were publicly critical of President Donald Trump's role in last week's storming of the Capitol building in Washington, the seat of the U.S. government. The official reason for the cancellation of the trip, originally to Brussels and Luxembourg, was the need to coordinate with a transition team from the incoming Joe Biden administration. But it comes after the unprecedented attack on American democracy that stunned many world leaders and U.S. allies. The Luxembourg leg of the trip was called off on Monday after Luxembourg's Foreign Minister Jean Asselborn called Donald Trump criminal for inciting the attack. Jean Asselborn described the outgoing U.S. president to RTL Radio as a political pyromaniac who must be brought before a court of law. The Reuters news agency and Fox News both quoted diplomatic sources as saying it was Luxembourg that had called off the meeting, a devastating snub from a tiny country for a Secretary of State that continually claims to have restored swagger to the U.S. State Department. Mike Pompeo was also due to meet the Belgian Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, Sophie Wilmers, who tweeted, whilst the assault in Washington was underway, Sophie Wilmers tweeted, these images are shocking, also because they hurt our democratic ideals. They show the extent of President-elect Joe Biden's task